Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
You know, Mark, do you like our title, Three's a Crowd? It's a really cool title, right?
I think so. We're about to find out if it's a cool title. I am certainly interested in what we're talking about today.
Well, although three's a crowd, I did want to start and ask Rebecca and David a little bit about the foreign component, which is starting to become an issue now that we are seeing things more on the practical level. So RIA, which is the EB5 Reform and Integrity Act, passed in March last year. Wow, it's almost a year.
Yeah.
Gosh. RIA prohibits any person who's not a U.S. national or a permanent resident to be involved with an RC. But does that mean they cannot be involved with a JCE or an NCE? JCE meaning the job creating enterprise or the new commercial or handling the new commercial enterprise?
So under RIA, it specifically mentions regional centers, that they don't want any foreign national in any part or ownership, any direction as part of the regional center. Now, it doesn't specifically say that foreign nationals aren't allowed to direct or own a new commercial enterprise or a job creating entity. But David, do correct me if I'm wrong. What's your take on it?
Yeah, well, it is only related to the regional centers. And it is creating a problem with those regional centers that already had foreign ownership. And I think that the jury is out on that. We're going to look to immigration for guidance. Will these foreign owners be grandfathered in, or do they have to get out of the deal and find new owners for the regional centers? It's a very important question, which we've actually found in practice as early as a day ago.
Right. But here's the issue, guys. I mean, obviously, this is the rule. Does it make sense? What's the purpose? I personally would say that I really do see the sense of a foreign person who's sitting in a different country, having control over money, which is being spent here, job creation, which is being spent here. I don't think it should happen. And we've seen this in litigation, Rebecca, right?
Yeah, we've seen it with the new commercial enterprise as well, where the foreign national has ownership of the NCE, and they have management control of that NCE, and we're seeing issues with that. So it's hard to go after someone who's sitting in another country when money isn't being released, jobs aren't being created. What do you do in that situation? And can you imagine when it's a regional center?
Rebecca, you've already started with the fact that go after, litigate. I think EB5 should be called EB Litigate 5. You know.
Well, I've got a slightly different take on that. In addition, not in replacement of, and that is certain individuals and organizations and maybe even governments abroad have nefarious objectives, and therefore it becomes a national interest issue.
Yeah.
That we want some of these foreign folks involved in some of the deals here, as bland and as vanilla as they may seem, they may be utilizing them for other purposes which are under the surface. So I think national interest is very important in this regard.
Wasn't this brought up some years ago when there was a port for sale that a company in Dubai wanted to purchase?
I think I recall something like that, yes. And there was a government fuss about it, that they didn't want foreign ownership of one of our ports. I'm not sure how that turned out. I think that eventually people backed off, and then I don't think the deal closed.
Yeah, the deal didn't close, but it certainly raised all the issues. So, David, what do you think we're going to see with regional centers who have foreign ownership now? Do you think USCIS might let the older ones pass, or do you think the rule is the rule and they will have to change?
Well, with USCIS treating all of its interpretations as the most conservative and narrow, I think they're going to cause a problem for those foreign owners.
Yeah, so those foreign owners will have to bring somebody else on board. Please correct me, I can't recall. Does RIA mean that you can have part ownership or no ownership?
I don't think you can have any ownership. That's my personal view.
I think you're right. No, it's zero.
It's no ownership. I think there was a bit on there about foreign entities, but again, I would just be cautious on how you're structuring that as well.
Well, how about if somebody comes up to us and says, look, I'm going to hide behind a couple of corporations. So I'll have a corporation which owns another corporation which owns the regional center. Will that work?
I don't believe it'll work. And I think it's going to require, through all the disclosures, you'll have to show who ownership, the ultimate ownership is. That would be a clear way for immigration to handle it. So I think that that's going to come out. You can't hide behind a corporate identity.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. I think it's going to come out somehow. They'll keep asking for ownership after ownership, and it will work its way out.
Well, also, we have the new Form H's, you know, the new alphabet soup that UCS brought up. So the Form H's require a fingerprint. So you would have to go for fingerprints anyway. So they would find out.
Yes, they would. So that's where they will eventually get to the individual owner, right? So an entity could own an entity to own an entity. But ultimately, at the end of the day, whoever owns that entity will have to go in, like you said, Mona, for biometrics.
Yeah. So, David, about our alphabet soup, about this new form, H. Now, H's are for anybody who's involved within the regional center. There's a whole gambit of discussion going on here. How many and who do we have? Do we have people from everybody, from the NC to the JCE to the RC? Or do we have just the JCE people? Do we just have the RC people? What's your take?
Well, I'm seeing that, again, with the conservative and narrow interpretation from immigration, that we're going to have to put everyone in. If they have some involvement in the ownership of the project or the management or the word involvement, which is not clearly defined. I think that there's a meeting coming up in March where immigration has indicated that it will be giving some clarity, but that, again, needs to be seen. So let's watch out for what immigration says in its determination, if it says anything.
Oh, we're going to have another podcast after that, special meetings to discuss.
Well, hopefully they come up with something during that meeting. But just to kind of go off of what David was saying is who is all involved? And I think in my take of it, it's going to be, and this is what, it's coming out from statute, it's that anyone who's kind of has some substantive authority, right? Someone who can make decisions, who can make operational managerial decisions on pooling, releasing of funds, anyone who has that kind of involvement. Now, I've had clients and others come up to us, right? And they always ask, well, does that mean someone who's employed? What if I have someone who's employed and just doing daily tasks? So it's just how much involved is that person within either the regional center, the NCE, or the JCE?
Well, I think David's point is correct. You don't take chances. You include everybody.
Exactly. Exactly. So then I know there are some that have just a few employees, but there's others that have quite a few, and that's going to be a lot of H's going in.
What's the fee for an H? Is it one of those big ones?
Well, it has to be attached, right, to the I-956F. So that's going to have a large fee of almost 18,000. But for the H itself, it's just an $85 biometrics fee.
Okay. Oh, well, it's 18,000 now. Let's see. Yeah. But what happens? The fee is another issue. I love the way they have their post and comment, and we can all post and comment during their period, but they still don't take any notice and they will put the fees up to what they want.
Mm-hmm.
Topic for another day.
Yeah. But I just also want to mention, Mona, too, the H forms. So the I-956H, not only is it to do with anyone with the regional center, it has to do with everyone who's part of, like we were saying, the regional center, the NCE, the JCE. And it also kind of takes out anyone who has been a bad actor in the past. So it's not just foreign owners or anyone in that situation. It's also for anyone who has had any bad conduct in the past.
Oh, that's a good point. That's a very good point. And over here, when we're filing the H's for the NCE and JCE, David, do you see any problems for a foreign ownership here?
Well, if there's ownership, you've got the problem if the ownership is in the regional center. Otherwise, the disclosure needs to be made and immigration will call for biometrics. And if it's abroad, I think they've created a provision for being able to get your biometrics done abroad at one of the US consulates. So I don't think that foreign folks who are involved, who are required to file the H, have an issue, but they must file the form. So it's basically, if you consider this whole area of the law as Congress was trying to push it through, the whole focus was protect the investors. And if we keep that in mind, we can understand a lot of what is going on here, even if we think it's some of it is quite overboard. But the goal is to protect the investors.
Okay, so we are protecting the investors, but what about projects which are already out there, which are handled by the regional centers who are now foreign owned?
I think we might see some issues later with those regional centers who are foreign owned, but that have projects in the past that are still ongoing. So what happens there, right? You know, if we came in now and say new rules replace foreign owned RCs, but what happened to the projects in the past? Where does that leave the investors?
Yeah, well, let's follow the process. If you have a regional center before the new law came in, you had the Baring court case. There's some discussion in that as to what happens to old ongoing projects. Then you have to look at which way the project is going. If it's continuing, part of the concept is it can continue. So there's argument there for grandfathering everything that has taken place. But when you file your I-956 to extend the project, you've got to give all these disclosures and all these forms. And that is the point where immigration may turn around and say, well, the new law says you've got to comply with all of these issues, and you're no longer in compliance because you have foreign ownership and it's not going to work.
So then the next option for a regional center of that type who's foreign owned is to lease or rent rather an existing regional center. But the rentals, as we know, David, have shrunk because of all of the compliance issues.
Correct. And the compliance issues are substantial, mainly because the penalties that are attached can get a regional center debarred. And it's very serious because if they have 20 projects, what happens to the other 19 besides the one that caused the problem? And I think it's an overbroad type penalty. And I think that may be challenged along the way. But in the meantime, it means all of those other projects that are scurry around and find new regional centers, because I think the law provides for that, whereas historically you couldn't change a regional center because that was regarded as a material change.
Right. At least that can be changed now. All right. Three's a crowd. Back to that. Agent disclosure. Again, this is going to be brought up at this meeting, but this has caused quite a consternation out there. There's a lot of confusion. Who is an agent? What is an agent? What's going to happen now that the agents have signed these forms? There's a lot of nervousness that we're seeing in Asia. Why is agent disclosure so important, David?
Well, the issue is that I believe that the investors may have had certain non-disclosures which might have affected their willingness to go into the transaction, particularly if they found out the amounts that the agents were receiving as compensation for the introduction. And this causes concern to a lot of the Asian agencies because they weren't disclosing this before. And I believe that if they start disclosing it, people will become adjusted to the norm and it won't be an issue anymore. But it's the jump between non-disclosure and disclosure where you can expect a fair reaction from the investing public.
Well, we've always called it agent just because that seems to be just the term which was used, which started from China. And it's interesting because USCIS doesn't call it agent. It calls it promoter. The term is anybody who promotes a project, which I feel is more accurate, Rebecca, because, you know, the agents, quote unquote, from you see in other countries like maybe India or stuff, they really don't do the same job that the agents do in China, nor are they registered. They do really just promote a project and get a fee for it.
Yeah, that's correct. But I think there's still some issues on the definition of promoter, right? And that some people, you know, the SEC itself has a definition of promoter, but a promoter is completely different from where it's going with USCIS. So I think for us, it's anyone, like you said, who receives a fee for an investor that goes into a project. So I think for anyone who's looking at it and who's kind of confused on this term, if you're earning money from someone, it doesn't matter what the percentage is. If you're earning money from that project or whoever is issuing, then it has to be disclosed.
Yeah, but David, we've heard now about all of these sub-agents not wanting to sign anything and because they feel they don't need to because they're sub.
It is an issue and it's becoming clear that one needs to sign, and hopefully immigration will give us some guidance on that. But it becomes a nightmare where you have a very large agency with multiple subs, as you mentioned. But I think anyone who actually brings the deal to the table and get some payment, and this is under the heading of follow the money, any of the money goes to someone, that person must be registered. That would be similar to SEC saying, if you're not a broker dealer, you can't get a commission. It doesn't matter how much, what portion, small or large, of the commission you get, you still break the law if you don't have a broker dealer's license.
Interesting that this is coming almost at the same time that they are now mandating the Integrity Fund. Because the Integrity Fund was just announced, when? A couple of days ago? Breaking news, if you haven't heard. Each regional center would have to pay either $10,000 or $20,000, which goes into a fund which allows the Department of State to go overseas and really do their investigations, which I thought they were doing before, because it was quite often that you would find that somebody from USAS, or rather Department of State, would be at an event just doing their normal day-to-day investigations. I suppose they can do more now.
There was a much greater presence of USCIS previously overseas, but with budgets and so on, I think they pulled a lot of that in. But we've had cases where three people have come out of the embassy, the fraud division, the consular division, and a USCIS agent. So they've showed up at a bank or at a business, and all three of them have been there. This just funds what immigration could use, and if it abused, could become great boondoggles for those who want to take a quick trip overseas and have some fun. it's going to be a lot of money. And in addition, we mustn't forget that there's $1,000 per EB5 regional center investor that's also going to be used for all of this integrity. And that's been the effect from the beginning. And those who haven't paid are going to get called for payment now, because now there's a method to pay through the government payment portal.
What's the date that this has to be paid by?
It's starting April 1, and it must be paid by the end of April, as I understand it.
Is that the $1,000 or the regional center?
Well, the $1,000 was from day one.
Yeah.
It hasn't been paid. Now the payment, and the same with the $20,000 or $10,000. It's been there from the beginning. There's just been no method of paying, and that's why immigration waived penalties and interest and all that stuff. But if you don't pay now by the end of April, as I understand it, penalties and interest and potential debarment and all of the bad stuff that follows non-payment will kick in.
So from my understanding, David, I thought it was April 1st, but are you including the 30-day? Because you get a 30-day reprieve to pay without being penalized. So I think that end of April includes that extra additional 30 days.
Yes, I believe you're correct, Rebecca. That's where that comes in. It 1st of April is the payment date, and then there's a grace period.
Yeah, I just hope that all of this coming in, it's, again, I'm going to go back to processing times, Mona, that, you know, you've got new forms, you've got all of this, you're asking for each sub-agent, each employee of these sub-agents, anyone who has an agreement with the NCE, JC, or RC, that it also doesn't slow down investor petitions as well, because we're hoping to get through these cases pretty quickly. And all of these other forms and additional integrity measures could take time.
Yeah, this is why I don't see those fees going down for EB5. They're going to increase those fees. But I have a question for you both. And there's words which are often used interchangeably, but they have different meanings, especially under the law. And I think it's important that we do state what the different meanings are. But what is the difference between an EB5 security issuer and an EB5 promoter?
My thought is the issuer is the NCE. And the promoter is anyone who goes out there to try and raise the funds for that NCE.
Yes. So to just kind of piggyback off of what David's saying is that the issuer is the one who is issuing the actual security, right? The project. So persons who are involved with it, who's been putting it up. So yeah, it could be the NCE who could be issuing the security. And the promoter can be just anyone who's wanting to sell the project.
Like a secondary relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Much like if a company is promoting their products, it's obvious that the company is promoting the product. But if, say, a promoter, a salesperson, or affiliate is doing it, those are different rules altogether.
Right. So would a security issuer, David, have to fill in a K form?
I think that they would be covered by the H forms.
I think you're right.
I think so too. Yeah.
trick question. I knew that. No, seriously.
You know, regional centers are there as a special purpose vehicle there to help with job creation, things like that. We have RCs that are, you know, you can rent in a regional center for that. But can regional centers also be promoters? Can they be out there promoting a project?
Well, I think they usually are. Only the rentals tend not to, unless they have equity or they have an arrangement. But yes, I think regional centres can be promoters.
I think so too.
They can be for sure, but they are not necessarily promoters.
Mm, that's right.
Yeah, so then do they, at that point, I guess they would still be protected under the Form H versus the K?
Yeah, but here's the thing, guys. I mean, we've had EB-5 in this country like we see it now since 2009. And I don't know about anyone else, but we certainly have been disclosing all the promoters and what migration agents get on the PPMs for so many years. Don't you agree?
Yeah, we've been doing that from, you know, best practices for some time. And I know there are a few others that have been doing that, but I think a majority of regional centers out there have not.
Yeah, that's correct, because it was shunned mainly by the Asian agents or migration agents, because they didn't want their clients to know what they were earning. It was a simple non-disclosure. And if they were true agents, they were breaking the basic rules of good faith that they have to display to all parties. So that disclosure is a basic tenet of agency.
You know where I see a bit of mess, Mona and David, is that obviously each agent promoter is going to have to submit this K form, and then you have to keep updating, right? If you are changing an agreement, if you're adding a new project onto your list, if you're coming out of one, you have to keep updating. And then of course the regional centers as well, when you're filing the I-956F, you also have to put in there, what agreements do you have with these promoters? And then at the time you're filing the I-956F, you may not even have a promoter at that time. So then what do they do at that point? Do they need to amend the F to include all of this as well? I just see a lot of confusion coming out of having to keep updated with each and every promoter that's coming out for these projects.
Well, it's certainly job creation, because you're going to go to hire someone to do it all.
Well, you can talk about updating, but we can go a stage further. Every new project that an agent takes on or a promoter takes on has to have a new agreement and has to have a registration, which requires the new agreement. So this is an ongoing for each project and for each new individual promoter who comes on board. There's a ton of work in that. I know that'll be boilerplate stuff, but each time it's got to be sent in. Now, in the original form, I believe you could file this electronically. And you could keep the agreement and produce it on request. Now you have to file it on paper and attach the agreement.
Yes, yes. And every agreement, like you said, every project that you go into, you have to put that agreement, include that agreement in that form as well.
And these agreements need to be carefully drafted. I've seen one from a securities lawyer that's probably 10 pages.
Oh, gosh.
Not just a one-liner that says this is what will be paid. It goes into all the obligations and responsibilities and liabilities and what the agent is not and what the agent may do. And a lot of that is probably important once you're getting into a contractual document with an agent, because this could bounce back on the issuer or the regional centre at a later time.
Do you think this is going to kind of scare some of these migration agents? Well, I don't want to say really scare agents away, but more like deter agents, which this has a really chilling effect, you know, with these new regulations coming out now for promoters. Do you think we're going to see less agents coming out now?
I do believe so. We've already seen a major reduction in the number of migration agents in China. A lot of the companies have been sold or they've moved into other fields. With the citizenship by investment closing down in several countries, these agents are now don't have that same series of options that they had previously, and they may start focusing back on the US or just get out of the business and stay with what most of them were doing as well, was education.
Yeah, I do see them coming back. We ourselves have been hearing inquiries from, I won't call them agents, but promoters from other countries where they are now looking at the US because of other programs closing.
Yeah. Good for business for our projects.
Yeah.
We won't talk about good for business for lawyers, because that's not a subject that should be spoken in public.
It's also a good topic for another podcast.
Well, the short discussion just shows just how many open questions we have. Though I can say that USCIS have progressed a lot, as long as they don't die on the hill of progress.
Ha 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 ha. thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshawlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice.